So with that, everything from this point forward gets recorded. The topic for this morning, and it's going to be, like I said in the email, this is definitely a two-week topic, even though, and unfortunately, the bulk of the Chaye Sara part of it has to be in the second half, just because of the way the topic works. But I wanted to talk about something which... I've spoken about this topic elsewhere on occasion, and something from Chaye Sara always bothered me. The topic in general is racism and race in Judaism. And it's not a simple thing, even though there are those who would like to say nice sort of platitudes about how Judaism is very positive about everybody, and everybody gets a share in Olam Haba and so forth. The issue of race in Judaism is inherently complicated. And when I've talked about it before, one issue in particular that's really nagged at me, and I always felt like I need to do something with it, is what happens in this week's parsha regarding a wife for Yitzhak, where Avram says to his Eved, we presume it's Eliezer, although the Torah actually doesn't name him there, but he says to him, don't take a wife for my son from the Canaanite women. Right? Instead, go back to my land and so forth. And it sounds like this is race-based, especially for reasons we're going to see in a little bit. And so the question that I think we need to ask is, what does Judaism believe regarding race? Are there traits that are inherited? I don't mean traits, physical traits. Are there spiritual traits, behaviors that Judaism thinks are inherited down the line? Can there be a bias against a particular race? That's the question that I want to look at. And like I said, it's really a 2-week topic in which, for the first week, we need to talk about race in Judaism on the whole, and then we'll be able to address the question of Abraham and who he wants to have marry Yitzhak. Clear? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Were they a separate race?
Well, Canaan?
Yeah.
So part of this is about defining what a race is, which is what we're going to have to talk about. That's part of it. But I would say that since really what bothers people about this topic is the idea that children will be identified and a population will be stereotyped based on an ancestor's behavior, right now I'm just going to say members of a family, an ethnicity. And in that sense, yeah, Canaan is a tribe. Now, it's a set of tribes. There are various Canaanite tribes. But each tribe in and of itself would be identified for this purpose as a race.
I never got the impression that the reasoning was because of a racial thing, but more like the way in which they behaved.
Their reputation?
Like they have
so, reputation. I'm going to come back to that. But I will just point out to you that the people he sends them to in Aram, Laban's family, right, they don't have a great reputation either in terms of their conduct, right? They're the ones Hashem said to Abraham, leave them and don't look back, right? If your issue really is Canaanite behavior, it's a little disingenuous. That's number one. But there are going to be more challenges to the idea that it's conduct-based. Just wait for it. We'll see. There's more. Take a look at the first source. This is a nice source to begin with. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, brother of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, in an essay called Civil Rights and the Dignity of Man, a wonderful essay. In general, I recommend the book, Logic of the Heart, Logic of the Mind. He says, from the standpoint of the Torah, there can be no distinction between one human being and another on the basis of race or color. Any discrimination shown to a human being on account of the color of his or her skin constitutes loathsome barbarity. I used to hear him speak. Like I can hear this in his voice when I was at YU. I was in high school there. My last year in high school, so he used to give a shiur, a parsha shiur, once a week. I think it was Tuesday nights in one of the dorms, and I used to stay over and hear him because my family has a connection to him. So I can this is his words. This is very much the way he would express it. But it's not only Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Take a look at source number 2 from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky is dealing with the pasuk of Arur Canaan, where Canaan gets cursed, right? After the whole incident with Noach and the embarrassment of Noach, he curses Canaan and he says, Eved Avadim Yehielechav, he shall be slave of slaves to his brethren. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky has this very strong comment in Emes Yaakov. He says, Hine, Yeshnan misoneinu meumos haolam. Hatoanim shekal Yisrael hi uma gizanit. He says, we have enemies among the nations of the world who claim that the Jewish people are racist. Sharei. Hatoro meres sheknan arur. Torah says, Canaan is cursed. We eved avadim le'achav, slave of slaves to his brethren. So the Torah indeed lowers Canaan and says they will be slaves. But he says the truth is it's not so. He says the Torah is against racism. He says, I've already demonstrated this earlier in Emes Yaakov, Milashona Mishnah, but Sanhedrin Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin there, in context, it's actually a Mishnah, is talking about what we say to witnesses before they testify in court, and how the witnesses are supposed to be intimidated by the judges, and that's really the word, Ma'aymin is the language of the Mishnah. They're supposed to threaten the witnesses and say, you know, if you lie, if you harm somebody who didn't deserve it, what you're doing is awful. And one of the things that they say about the stakes involved is, Mipnei ma nivra ha'adam yechidi. Why does Hashem create Adam alone? Meaning, all the other animals, all the birds and all that, they're created male and female, male and female. He starts Adam, one human being, to start to start humanity. Why? Shalomar Adam machavero, abba gadol me'avicha. So that no one should say to anyone else, my father's better than yours. Our ancestry, fundamentally, Jew, non-Jew, black, white, whatever it is all identical. Hashem did this for humanity, different from what he did for everybody else, creates Adam solo. So that people not come to what he calls midah meguna. Racism is, he says, a disgraceful trait. Ela shel fize. So knew what did Adam do to Canaan? What did Noah do to Canaan? This seems to be pure racism. He says that it has no connection to racism. The gizanut perusha shegeza echad mitnasei me'al geza acher. I keep going back and forth in Ashkenaz. It's probably like the same sentence. He says the meaning of racism is that one race elevates itself above another, biglal motzo v'yichuso, because of its origins, because of its lineage, uki'ilu shu notzar mechomer ilayi v'tov yoseruch doma, as though it was made from some kind of superior material. It is inherently better than. Avokan hatam shechilek beinehem Noach haya mishum midosav hamushchasos shalcham ubno Kenan. The reason why Noach distinguishes here is because Kenan, Cham, his father, and then Kenan himself have horrible traits. It's their behavior. Umidos elu hinchil hulabanav acharav, which Kenan would then pass along to his kids after him, but not pass along genetically, but rather, Kamosha Amru Chazal Hamisha Dvarim Tziva Kenan Es Banav. The Gemara says Kenan gave his children five instructions, and it's all about bad behavior that he's telling them to pursue. So, if I stop here, right, just with these sources, it's very easy. Judaism is not racist at all. Anytime that we look down on them, it's because their behavior is bad. And the truth of the matter is, you can support that very easily. Meaning the fact that Judaism accepts people who convert to Judaism from anywhere, right? We had our shiur about Amalek last year and talked about even an Amaleki converting to Judaism, would seem to suggest that, yeah, we're all, you know, created of the same material, maybe not everybody's a member of the Brit, not a member of a covenant, but that's a different story, as we're going to come back to show.
People won't say that this is still racism, like this stereotyping of like the father's evil, so therefore all the children are evil?
So the question will be, and Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's answer will be, are you really stereotyping them, or are you saying it's parent-taught child, but in the event that you see that it's not so, you see that that's not their behavior, then I won't make any assumptions about them. It's a default assumption that people learn behaviors from their ancestors. That's the that's the assumption. The problem is this really true? I mean, I'm not asking the question of are Jews racist, because we all know Jews who tell jokes they shouldn't be telling and make assumptions and say things that express a racist behavior, or racist attitude. But within Judaism itself, is there nothing you can come up with aside from don't marry Canaan, which I want to come back to? Is there nothing you can come up with that is racist in Judaism? So Amalek, right, seems to be.
Amalek.
I mean, Amalek we talked about again last year, and is it really about behavior or is it really about race? Or, you know, the Rambam's idea that we could get out of being an Amaleki actually. Amon and Moav, you know, is not so much an assumption about their identity as it is, I'm just punishing them. It doesn't matter. An individual Moabite could be wonderful. You have the male equivalent of Ruth. It doesn't matter. They can't marry in. It's a decree against them.
Even Kohanim and Levim and Yisrael, amongst the Jewish people, there's a hierarchy.
But assigning a hierarchy and saying there are laws that are going to apply to these people and not to those people doesn't say anything about their personal identity. It's not saying Kohanim are better people than not. It's not saying Kohanim are better people and therefore they get to do this. It's saying, here's one role and we're giving it to them. Here's another role, we're giving it to them. Here's another role, we're giving it to them. It's not because they're better. It's simply because this is how the rules break down, or it's a gift given to Aharon about who his descendants will be.
But racists would argue that argument as well. Like, in today's day and age, you couldn't call someone who has dark skin, you couldn't call them black. That would be making a racist comment, but all we're doing is describing them or ascribing a trait to them, which is like what we're saying about Kohanim.
Right. So there, what I think you're going towards, maybe this is what Nachum intended also, I don't know, is there is a distinction we're going to have to make between two different types of racism. One is to say that certain traits are identified with a particular population, a particular ethnicity, neither good nor bad, but there are certain things that are passed down. Not only might eye color or skin color or whatever it is, some phenotype, be identified with a particular family, but also there may be behaviors. They like certain kinds of food. They, whatever it is, that we're going to say, this is not learned. It's genetic. It's part of their basic identity. That's one attitude which could be called racist. The other is to assign particularly negative traits to a particular race. Not to say people who come from this place or people who are descendants of this line have these neutral traits, but actually they are thieves. They're greedy. They, you know, fill in the blank, whatever thing people have said about Jews, right? Whatever negative trait you assign, that's a second type of racism. And that's a distinction that's going to become very important. But if Judaism isn't racist, if Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky can really say that there's no distinction based on race, that Arur Canaan is about the behaviors that Canaan is going to pass down, look at number three. This is what I talked about in the beginning. Abraham says to his Eved, V'ashbi'acha b'Hashem Elokei HaShemayim v'Elokei HaAretz, I demand that you swear by Hashem, God of the heavens, God of the land, asher lo sikach isha livni mibnos haknani asher anochi yoshev b'kirbo. Do not take a wife for my son from these Canaanite women among whom I live. Go back to my land, go back to the place I was born. And there, you get a wife for my son, for Yitzchak. And again, saying he may not marry a Canaanite is a very large brush to use to tar an entire group. No righteous Canaanites whatsoever, apparently, if we're going to assume that this is about righteousness. We're going to come back to that because that's simply not true. So, This is a problem. This is not something you can just wish away. One thing that I think is important to stress from the outset is not to confuse race with Jewish and non-Jewish. Meaning, Torah Halacha does give preferences for Jews in certain areas because they are family or because they are members of the Brit. They're members of this covenant that we have with Hashem. So, you know, the classic example is Ribbis, right? You know, lending money and charging interest. Where, you know, I think I've mentioned this before. The technical financial term for an interest-free loan is no. What's a technical financial term for an interest-free loan? It's called suicide. It is, because what happens when you lend someone money without charging interest? What's your best case scenario? You get paid back on time, in full, without having to go after them, right? At which point you have only lost, number one, inflation, and number two, opportunity cost, right? You're always behind, and that's the best case scenario, as opposed to they don't have the money to pay you back, as opposed to they delay paying you back. Right? You have to take them to court in order to get paid back. An interest-free loan is a bad idea from a financial perspective. What the Torah calls it is tzedakah. And it says, we're not going to have you do this for people at large, because if you do, you'll go broke. However, when it comes to family, then you have to extend interest-free loans because there's a greater value than your personal financial success, and that is the continuity of this nation that has the covenant with Hashem. But you're giving priority to people who are members of the covenant, but it's not a race-based thing. And if you take a look at source number 4, my friend Rabbi Daniel Feldman points this out, the line, the Orach Chaim, from the beginning of Parashat Yisro. Remember, that Chaim makes a comment about the fact that Hashem plans to give them instructions anyway about judges. That judicial system is not Yisro's invention. So why does Torah present it that way? So if you take a look at source number 4, V'nira kitam hadavar hu laharos Hashem es b'nei Yisrael hador hahu v'chol dor v'dor. Hashem wants to show the Jews of that generation and of every generation. Ki yesh b'umos gedolim b'havanu b'haskala, that we don't have a monopoly on insight and understanding. V'tzeyu l'man me'haskalas Yisro b'atzaso. Look at Yisro. Ki lo ba'ah ha'bechira b'Yisrael v'tzad sheyesh b'am haskala v'akra yosim mikol ha'umos. No matter what people want to tell you about Nobel Prizes, we were not selected for this covenant with Hashem because of some greater intellectual acumen. El chesed elyon u'l'ahavas ha'avos. It was Hashem's chesed for us and his love for our ancestors. That's why we had it. There's nothing unique inherently, genetically, in the Jewish line. That's the point of the Or HaChaim. And of course, you find that all over the place within Torah. Sorry? True, that someone tells you they learned something wise from someone who wasn't Jewish, of course you should believe it, as opposed to Torah, which we're told Torah is something that we have uniquely. But, you know, the fact that we read Megillas Rus on Shavuos, right? I always like that as an example. Who's the hero in Megillas Rus? Rus, right? Is there any other?
Naomi,
sort of, except, you know, abandoned their people and left in the time of the famine, right?
Boaz,
sort of, except that, you know, he helped out Ruth by, you know, letting her glean barley behind all the gleaners, you know, with all the gleaners. Like, yeah, that was very sweet of him. I don't want to take anything away from Boaz. I don't want to take anything away from Naomi, but the real hero of the story, which we're reading on Shavuos, is Man Matan Tarasenu, is the one who wasn't Jewish. Right? The one who was the Moabite. So
she converted.
Yeah. That's my point. There's nothing about the genes of the Jew that makes them special, because she's coming from the outside. That's my point. I mean, you could, if you wanted to play the biblical game, go back to Lot. Yes, at the end, well, of course she is. You could say, well, she goes back to Lot, and therefore that's Avram's family, and, you know, you can do that. If you take a look at number 5, I brought you the continuation from Ravan Soloveitchik's article, where he notes this as well. It must be conceded that the Torah recognizes a distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew. This distinction, however, is not based upon race, origin, or color, but rather upon Kedusha, the holiness endowed by having been given and having accepted the Torah. Furthermore, the distinction between Jew and non-Jew does not involve any concept of inferiority, but is based primarily upon the unique and special burdens that are incumbent upon the Jews. We have a Torah that we're obligated to follow, that the nation accepted, and that is what confers a level of uniqueness. So this isn't about Jew and non-Jew. But now we have to come back to identify what exactly racism is. So race in general can be explained in a variety of ways. I taught a class on this topic without going into the whole parsha issue, just a piece of this topic at Limud. Last Sunday, the Sunday before, whenever that was, and someone told me something I had never heard, that apparently in Brazil, you could have two races in the children of the same family based on the color of their skin being different. In other words, they will actually call that a different race. If one kid is darker and one kid is lighter, they'll actually call that a different race, which destroys completely what I would have expected is the definition of race, which is parentage. You come from a certain line. They're doing it much more based on visible expression of the genes, phenotype. I would assume that that's how it happens. Parents, grandparents, whatever, something's there in the line to cause that.
Racism is generally like a negative something they're saying. It's not, but just saying that someone is.
So before we get to racism, just how would you define race? Before you get to racism. See, fundamentally, race is sociological. It's society getting together and saying, this is how we are going to define families that are related to each other and families that are not related to each other. But it's up to society to make that up. You know, much of what society does is like that. We make the mistake of calling something medical or legal when what it really is just society decided this is a definition. You know, completely different conversation, but the whole debate that goes on about the moment of death, when is somebody considered dead? So a lot of people are trying to make this a medical discussion, but it's not a medical discussion. It's based on medical data, but the discussion of which data constitutes alive and which data constitutes dead is fundamentally a social decision. Society says, we think that when the brain is functioning at this level, or we think that when the heart is functioning at this level, or whatever it is. In Judaism, obviously, we look to the Torah and say, well, what does the Torah tell me? But fundamentally, it's not a medical statement, you know, such that doctors should be the ones to decide. If anyone should decide, it's the lawyers. The lawyers are representing society in terms of determining what the law is. But the same thing is true regarding race. It's not really something that is scientific. It's really about what society chooses to identify as a race. Normally, society does it based on ethnic lines. You descended from, you know, this particular population, and therefore this is who you are. Right? And that's how you can end up with these weird censuses. I've never had a census in Canada, so I don't know how it works here. But certainly, when I was in university or just the general census in the U.S., like, you'll have questions like, are you Caucasian? Or are you from, you know, the Middle East? Or are you whatever it is? And, like, you look at it and think, well, I could check this box. Or I could check this box. You know, the labels are very confused at this point. But I would work with a basic definition of race that associates it roughly with ethnicity.
But the population, when? 1850? Like, when your ancestors lived where, at what date?
Well, that's the problem.
Right? We're all European, but maybe we're not, because maybe our ancestors lived in Morocco.
Correct.
But we don't even know that.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And it's only going to be based on what can be identified, which until everybody gets their ancestry tested, you know, genetically, is going to be done by people based on the visual. They're going to look at somebody and say,
right,
no,
but in
100 years from now, I mean, we're all Canadian. Our descendants are Canadian,
so far. I mean, you're assuming an awful lot. I'm hoping Israeli, but
okay, but I understand. Identify as Jews, but right, but the rest of the are assuming they'll just be Canadians.
I think so.
Even if some people have like darker skin, lighter skin, they look Middle Eastern, they look like this, they'll just be Canadians.
That's what the government's ad campaign say.
You wouldn't call my mother American. She's already 4/5 American.
She is really American,
right?
Yeah, I mean, that's Yeah.
I think once it's three generations here.
So, but that's going back to...
I mean, the problem with saying... The reason why I'm not comfortable with saying just Canadian is because that's really much more of a political entity than it is a racial entity. It makes more sense to say almost Torontonian than Canadian, because at least there's a defined population that you can point to, where even if... I shouldn't say that, because even their municipalities redraw their lines, and then you're stuck.
I just think like maybe not 100 years or 200 years, there will be a population of people who probably are vitamin D deficient and very pale skinned, and they'll say, oh, they're Canadian.
Right.
And then that will be like a phenotype of Canadians.
Right.
Those Canadians are dark skin. It's a melting pot, though. No matter how vitamin D.
I don't know why he doesn't make that distinction, because they look.
And the answer is, it's whatever society says. I mean, it really is. If they start using Canadian as a race, which I'd be a little surprised if they did, especially because, again, the border with the U.S. is fairly porous. You know, they're more apt to say North American in the same way that they say Scandinavian. Right? Scandinavian has come to be a race. It's a whole bunch of countries. I think that works as a racial identity. In the same way that African, right, has... A racial identity to it, even though there are a lot of different tribes and there are a lot of different countries, and nonetheless, people look at it and say, well, that's African.
Yeah, European, same thing, too.
I suppose. Right.
Asian?
A lot of it is just dependent on the way you think. I mean, Asian is the ultimate misnomer.
Right.
Because that's an awfully big world. Place.
Yeah.
And there are
distinct physical...
And that's... Which brings me exactly to number six. That was perfect. Hadassah, thank you for the segue. Look at number six. This is from Professor Geraldine Heng from the University of Texas. Did race and racism exist in the Middle Ages? The short answer is yes. Race is one of the primary names we have for our repeating tendency to demarcate human beings through selected differences that are identified as absolute and fundamental, so as to distribute power differentially to human groups. Leave aside the end of her sentence for the moment. It's what human beings do in order to identify different groups in a way that we claim is absolute, even though we all know that it's just about where you're drawing the line. So if somebody says Asian, as an example, we all know that that's absurd, because it includes people from India, it includes people from Japan. You know, to call them the same race is bizarre. However, if you were to talk to people who live in India, they will tell you that to say somebody is Indian as a race is bizarre, because we have subpopulations within that may look a little bit different, that certainly have a different culture and a different heritage. And I'm not talking about religion now, in terms of the Buddhist, Hindu, Islam, you know, blends of populations, which you know, often don't mix. The reality is that, as she puts it here, it's more our tendency to try to identify people in different groups. And as she says at the end of her sentence, often it's about power and who's going to get the power if you're from the right population. In race making, strategic essentialisms, which is a great word, are posited and assigned through a variety of practices, right? An essentialism, to say that this is the essence of somebody, that this person has a certain identity, and they will have these traits because they come from this background. Race is a structural relationship for the management of human differences. It's something we come up with. It's something that human beings work with. I'm trying to think where this was. This came up in a different shear. Oh, right. I had a shear years ago on sociology and the sociology of shuls and the way that, you know, people also will break down within the shul. Like, this is the young couples, you know, group within the shul, and these are the retirees, and this is whatever. You know, each demographic subdivides itself. When people look at it from the outside, we'll just say, these are the Jews. They go to that synagogue, and that's it. But, like, we divide ourselves up and assign things based on that. It's a natural human trait. So, now approaching racism, racism has these two different components, one of which is where you judge the individual member of a race based on traits that are assumed to belong to the race in general. That's one definition of racism. It isn't positive or negative. just to say, you are from Iceland, therefore, or Scandinavia, the way I said it before, therefore, I can assume certain things about you. And again, whether you want to do North American, Canadian, Trentonian, or whatever it is, you are from this family, this, you know, ethnicity, therefore I can make certain assumptions about you, neither positive nor negative. That's one way to define racism. It's simply extrapolating from a person's race to determine what they're like. The second approach is to specifically associate negative traits with a particular race. You're from that race, therefore you must be bad in the following ways.
But if that's the case, the first one, we look nothing like Abraham or those people. They look more like the Africans. So how could we base our identity and our genetics? We're not like them at all.
Not according to the Parsha books.
Right. So I don't know what Abraham looked like.
Not like this.
That's a safe bet. Right. So my answer to that is that Judaism is a blend. The Jewish nation is clearly not solely ethnic, based, number one, on the fact that there's conversion, but also based on the fact that we've lived everywhere. And that the definition of being Jewish is not passed along paternally, but only maternally. If it were truly ethnic, then it should just be biological, right? Forget conversion, certainly, but also, why should it just be matrilineal? Judaism is not only ethnic. On the other hand, it's not solely a religious identity, because you can't lose the identity of being Jewish. As far as Judaism is concerned, you're born to parents who are Jewish. It doesn't matter what you practice. It doesn't matter what they practice. You're still Jewish.
Yeah, but eventually that goes away, because if people have ascribed to zero part of being Jewish, like people intermarry and then...
That's only because they don't tell you that they're Jewish, though. In other words, if I meet somebody and... You know, they don't act in any way Jewish, don't identify in any way as Jewish, but they tell me my mother's 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 mother was Jewish, I'm going to view them as Jewish. Right? I'm not going to say, but your last name is, fill in the blank with really non-Jewish last name. It's not going to matter to me. And even though yesterday I didn't know this about them and never would have guessed, that happened to me this week. Someone came to me and he mentioned that he talked to somebody who told him that he goes to my shiurim, or he's been to my shiurim, and he mentioned the fellow's name, and his name is Christopher. And I was trying to place who this person was, and I couldn't place who it was, and he said, well, you know that he's not a Yid. And then later on I remembered who this was, and actually the person is. He's Jewish. But this person assumed not, I gather, because, you know, when your name is Chris, generally speaking, you assume that indicates something. But it doesn't. So my answer to that is that that's about lack of knowledge. We don't know they're Jewish. It's not that they've stopped being Jewish. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein had a great essay on this called, I don't remember what it was called, but it was about the Brother Daniel incident in the 1950s. Brother Daniel was a Polish Jew named Shmuel/Oswald Rufeisen, who, through a whole series of events, ended up being a captive during World War II, and then he hid with, at one point he was hidden in a monastery. Bottom line is, it's a whole series of bad events, and he ends up converting to Christianity and becoming a Carmelite monk after the war. And he decides he wants to make Aliyah as a Jew under the law of return. And, of course, you know, he's a practicing Carmelite monk. He wants to go to Mount Carmel to be in a monastery. And he insists that he will not... They told him, like, don't try to do this as a Jew. Just say you want to emigrate to Israel, and then no problem, we'll take you, and that's it. But he insists, I have a right as a Jew. And Ben-Gurion doesn't know what to do. And it becomes this whole thing of, does he get to consider himself Jewish? And this was a very big issue post-war, when people are scared about, you know, whether there will even be Jews, and Jews leaving the fold or having been murdered. There's a whole thing, there's a book. What happened was, Ben-Gurion sends out letters to rabbis, scientists, thinkers around the world asking their opinion on who is a Jew, on matrilineal descent, patrilineal descent, and how to deal with this case. And there's a book collected, Rabbi Baruch Litvin, collected in many of the letters that he got a hold of the answers that he got from different figures around the world. It's fascinating. It's really a remarkable read. But Rabbi Lichtenstein wrote an essay about this at one point in which he talked about how being Jewish means, on the one hand, yes, accepting the ethnic side of it, you are part of the family, and on the other hand, it also means the religious piece of it, and it's really a hybrid. He pointed out that the language, when someone wants to convert to Judaism, is a language of, on the one hand, you accept these religious obligations, but on the other hand, you know, you're joining a family which has gone through all of these things. The family piece of it is also part of it. And how when someone converts to Judaism, so they say, Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu, right? Our God, God of our ancestors, because they've accepted Abraham's line as their line. Right, I always like to think about it in terms of the Greek person who converts to Judaism, and then on Hanukkah says "Asanisim la'avoseinu." But whereas the rest of us, you know, who are not Greek, are thinking God performed miracles for our ancestors, he's thinking God performed miracles to our ancestors. But that's the way it works. We all say it. We all say "la'avoseinu." But going back towards this, the answer to the question is that yes, Judaism is not a clear cut ethnicity; it's a blend of ethnicity and religion.
So why does Abraham not have a problem, just going back to our original point, marrying Hagar and having a kid when he's never when he didn't have an heir through Sarah?
Right.
And she's from a different.
Right.
She's from Mitzrayim, so that's not.
So if he doesn't like Canaan, why is he okay with Mitzrayim?
Yeah.
So we still have to get to Canaan, and like I said, this is a 2-weeker, so I'm not bothered by the fact that it's going to take us time. But clearly he sees something about Canaan that he doesn't see about Mitzrayim. I think that's true. I think that's correct. Okay. He's also been promised a child with Sarah, that's worth noting. But the former kind of racism, the kind where you just assume that people will be a certain way because they're from a certain trait, I think is very clearly found in Judaism. I think to pretend that Judaism doesn't do that is to ignore a whole lot of evidence. I brought you one source, which I think is actually debatable. We're going to come back to this point later on. But take a look at source number 7. When the Torah introduces us to Canaan, it says that Noah has 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafes, and Ham is the father of Canaan. Now, the truth of the matter is, Ham is the father of 4 sons that we know of, Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. So why does the Torah tell me Ham is the father of Canaan? So one answer could be because of the story that's going to happen involving Noah and Ham, and the Canaan is involved. But Ibn Ezra says no. Source number 7. V'cham avi Canaan. L'lamed sheshnehem ra'im. Teaching that they're both bad. Uchmaaseh avos yasu banim. Kids are going to do as their ancestors do. Now, you could debate this and say, that doesn't mean genetically. It could mean parents teach their kids things, like what we saw from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky above, right? That a word Canaan is because of the actions that are going to be taught, not because of traits that are inherited. But that's really not what it sounds like. It's not what it sounds like he's saying. It sounds like he's saying that kids do, they have certain traits as their ancestors do. But if you want a better piece of evidence, it's number 8. It's a Gemara. And granted that, this is Gemara rather than a Pasuk, it's expressing an idea that I think is drawn out of Tanakh, but the Gemara happens to do this really clearly. This is about one of Daniel's visions. Daniel has a bunch of visions which involve representations of different nations. And in this one, he sees various beasts. So I brought you one example of how the Gemara reads his visions. He has a vision of a bear. V'aru cheva achari tinyana dame ledov. Right? In came a second beast, and it looked like a bear. So Tani Rav Yosef, Elu Persiyim. Rav Yosef says, these are the Persians. She'ochlin v'shosin kedov. They eat and drink like a bear. Umasur balin kedov. And they are fleshy like a bear. Umagadlins say are kedov, and they grow their hair like bears do. Ve'im lahem menucha kedov, and they are restless like bears. Now, anyone from Iran want to acknowledge that right now? Anyone consider themselves Persian? I'm only reading the news. It's clear, right? There's an identity that is based on where they come from. And you can't color this any other way.
When Yaakov blesses his children, he gives them an identity. So I think the same thing here. They're going to be known for future generations as this type. But this is like...
But he gives them an identity, or he recognizes in them an identity?
I think it's both. He blesses them, and the power that they have is going to continue, but he recognizes their strengths and weaknesses, and it's highlighted in the bracha.
Right. And the Shvatim are a good example of groups that we do assign certain traits to, even though you go back one more generation.
They're all one.
I mean, well, paternally they're all one. Maternally they're four. it's very funny the way we do it, but we absolutely do that in Tanakh based on Shevet identity. And that's, frankly, a longer discussion about how the Shevet identity works. We haven't done that, Shalach.
This reads pure racism.
Yeah,
of course.
Oh yeah, no, if you put this on a billboard.
Yeah, I'm saying no Persian wants to be called fleshy.
That's the problem, just the fleshy. This is about Jews and non-Jews from Persia.
This is about...
Or was it related to non-Jews?
This is about people from Persia. It is not Jews or non-Jews.
That's
an overall statement.
It's not racist.
What do you mean?
Because an ethnicity has types, so it's racist type one. We're not degrading someone for power or a social construct. You're saying they tend to look like this.
I mean, it is a social construct, but it is... you're right that it's not intended as degrading.
It's okay. They are not terrible qualities or traits. They noticed a difference. And they're in their mind, the bear in a dream, okay, some ridiculous dream, but the bear means it's a Persian.
That bear looks Persian.
I'm not going to assign it to a Scandinavian redhead or whatever.
Yes.
So it's okay to interpret what your dreams might mean.
I'm not even at that stage of, is it okay to have this kind of racism? I'm still at the stage of, does Judaism have it? But I think that it is clear that the first kind is there, and human beings do it. The degrading kind is where we have to go next. And that's the question of, does Judaism assign negative traits as a default for a race, something that it would see as bad conduct? When I say negative, I don't just mean this person is described as being hairy and X person likes that and Y person doesn't like that. I'm talking about traits that you will recognize as the Torah is looking at that person and saying, this person's bad. You don't want anything to do with that person. So this is a big discussion, and there's a lot more than I'm going to be able to get into now with it. Actually, we set the Shari Shemayim Shabbaton for the spring. This is going to be our theme. It's going to be race and Judaism. So that'll be interesting, and there we'll have more of a discussion. But based on the opening,
we're
sources,
planning now for what happens in the spring. Mm-hmm.
Yes, May 9th. So what we saw from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and what we saw from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik is a statement that no, Judaism does not associate negative traits with a race by default. If you take a look at source number 9, Rav Aaron gives you the logic. Same essay. He says, the Torah says in Genesis, in the image of God, he created man. This metaphysical idea leads to the halachic principle of kvod habriyos, the dignity of man, right? We have a rule in the Gemara, and it's paskin as halacha, that where observing a rabbinic law would cause a person to lose their dignity, how you define that is very debatable, but it would cause them to lose their dignity overrides the rabbinic law. That's called kvod habriyos. And there's even some application of it to a Del Raisa, to a biblical, under certain circumstances. So he says that comes from the idea of Tzelem Elokim, that we're all created in this image designated for us by God. And he says the concept of dignity of man is not only a metaphysical concept, but it also has a legal counterpart. That's the point that I was mentioning, whose scope is broad enough to include all human beings, since all were created in the image of God. This idea is contained in the saying of Ben Azai, Pirkei Avos, right? Al tibaz l'chol adam, despise not any man. The expression any man implies, as the commentaries say, that even pagans must be treated with respect, and it is a sin to despise them, and so on. Where this came up, in particular, was with the Ethiopian, I'm going to use the term Ethiopian Jews, recognizing that there was a classic debate as to whether they were Jewish or not Jewish, where the early answers when they were first found was absolutely Jewish. And then in the 1950s, Rav Herzog came out with a position saying not so fast, believing that this was actually good for them to say not so fast, because if they're Jewish and their marriages and their, more important, divorces had not been conducted halakhically, then there's a possibility that they would all be labeled mamzerim and be unable to marry. Whereas if they're not Jewish, then they can just undergo a conversion and then start from scratch. So this was a very, very controversial issue. And if you want, and maybe I'll send out a link later, I gave a class on this and some of the issues that came up over time. But basically what it resulted in, when Rav Herzog said that, was it resulted in really a halt of all the government initiatives to bring them to Israel until Obadiah Yosef came out with a tshuva in the 1970s saying that they are Jewish. There was more involved. It wasn't only about this halakhic issue. There were social and economic issues, unfortunately, involved as well. It's more complicated than that. But the point for us is that in the 80s, a whole bunch of articles came out from various halakhic authorities saying you can't say anything about them based on race, based on skin color. That has no halakhic standing. If you take a look at source number 10, Rav Moshe Feinstein, a letter that he put out on the topic, he says, "And I was very pained to hear that there are such people in Israel who refrain from drawing near the Ethiopians in spiritual matters, causing them, God forbid, to be lost from Judaism. It appears to me that they do this only because their skin is black. It is obvious that one must draw them close, not only because they are no worse than other Jews and there is no legal distinction due to their blackness, dot, dot, dot." Rabbi J. David Bleichen, number 11, is talking about the black Jews phenomenon, which there obviously are Ethiopians who have that skin color, but there are also a lot of groups in North America who claim to be the real Jews, that white Jews are European in origin and come from the Kuzarim, and that the real Jews are black. So he writes in the beginning of his essay on this topic, "Judaism is colorblind. Skin pigmentation is unknown as a halachic concept. The problem of determining the status of the various communities of black Jews is totally unrelated to color. The sole issue is that of Jewish identity," in 1972. There's also a great poem by Rav Shlomo Aviner, which I was going to reproduce here, but it's a very long poem. He talks about his response to Ethiopians and how we're all the same. It's a nice poem. I should send that link to that too. Maybe I'll just link to
that. Rav Moshe Feinstein is not understanding that maybe some of the people who were hesitant at that time is because they weren't sure that the Ethiopians were Jewish, not because of their color.
Right. So
I felt like it more had to do with the fact that they were so remote and disconnected.
Yeah, right.
Well, that was part of the halachic standing, was that issue of their remoteness. That's true. But
And there were differences in how they were practicing as opposed to, like, large, you know, groups of other Jews.
Yes.
It wasn't like you looked at their community and it was unbelievable because everything was consistent.
Right, and that's true. There was a lot that was consistent, but yes, it is true. But these statements came out not only from rabbis who said they are Jewish, but also rabbis who said they're not Jewish. They also, I think Rabbi Blatt's conclusion is to say that they're not. But he says it's not because of skin color.
Right. Rav Moshe Feinstein believed that they were, like, that we should accept them.
So I was trying to remember what Rav Moshe's position was, and I don't remember. I think he said whatever Rav Ovadia said. I think he followed Rav Ovadia on it, but I'm not sure of that. I have to go back and look.
So they didn't all undergo conversion, or is it?
The end was conversion.
Yeah. It's very complicated.
It's like, why not?
Yeah.
Because right. I worked with soldiers who were converting in the army, and I had Ethiopians who
part of their family was considered Jewish, but they were, like, some of the siblings weren't, some weren't. It was very, and they were very sensitive about it. No, they were going through a conversion program that I was teaching in, and some of their other family members didn't have to go through this conversion. So mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the whole Bar Kan thing last year was just a renewal of that, where they had Ethiopian Mashkichim and the question, Bushel, and that was a nightmare. The upshot, though, is supposed to be, as I understand it, that there is judgment of individual members of races saying that they will have traits that the race as a whole has, but that the degrading version of this, where you assume negative things and treat people badly as a result, is not acceptable. Amalek is really the standout question, right? What do you do with Amalek in all of this? And the short answer to the Amalek question is that that's why you have all of these different writers who present different explanations for Amalek. Because on the one hand, you tell me there's no negative assumptions. On the other hand, you're saying that they are enemy and you have to wipe them out. And it doesn't matter like who they are and what they're doing. It's just based on their ethnicity. And that's what leads to statements like the Rambam statement that actually, no, they can convert out of that. They're not automatically Amalekite. That's where you get Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rav's father, who says that Amalek is actually the ideological enemy of the Jew. It's not about ethnicity. I think they're wrestling with this problem. There's a lot more to say. So, yeah, we got through the general racism topic, but now we have to still go to the Chayei Sara part of it. So, God willing, next week, we're going to see different approaches to understanding, six different approaches to understanding what was going on with Abraham's refusal to let Yitzchak marry a Canaanite, and that will give us some grasp of the issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you.